And welcome to This Green Earth, a weekly talk show about the environment and our impacts upon it. I'm Claire Wiley, and today we are going to be talking lizards and squid with conservationist and author Tor Hansen. Hansen shares more about his book, Hurricane Lizards and Plastic Squid, The Fraught and Fascinating Biology of Climate Change. And then author Susan Casey joins us to share more on her writings, including her latest book. It's called The Underworld, Journey to the Depths of the Ocean. All that and more coming up today on This Green Earth. Stay with us. And we are now welcoming to the show Tor Hansen, who is a biologist, conservationist, Guggenheim Fellow, and author of Hurricane Lizards and Plastic Squid. Welcome to the show, Tor.
Well, thanks for having me on.
Well, first, let me just say, I think in your writing, it's very clear that you have a passion for your line of work. And I want to first talk about you and what led you down this path and how did you enter this world into conservation biology?
Oh, well, it traces all the way back to a whole series of salamanders and frogs and snakes and things that I would catch as a child. I was always that kid with something in a terrarium someplace. So I've always had an interest in the natural world, and also always had an interest in writing. So when I was an undergraduate, I did a double major in ecology and writing, and then the science side of things sort of took over from there, and I went on to do my doctorate and so forth in conservation biology. But I always had that interest of the writing as well. So for a while, I was telling myself every time I wrote a scientific paper, I would write a popular article explaining it, and that lasted for about one paper. But it's just too busy to do it all. But later, after some period of time, I got the chance to write a book and devote myself full time to the writing. And in the decade or 15 years since then, I've started spending more and more of my time on that communications part of things, being a what I like to think of as a storyteller of science.
And you are that. And we want to get into this book, Hurricane Lizards and Plastic Squid. First of all, the title in and of itself is so intriguing. What led you to write this book?
You know, well, the book was inspired in part, I have to say, by this iconic image that I think we can all imagine on our heads right now. And it is the polar bear stranded on a lonely iceberg that is melting all around the bear. This is sort of our iconic go-to picture for the impacts, the biological impacts of climate change. And I've always looked at that and thought, but there's so much more. That's so incomplete. Our conversation shouldn't stop there, because the biology is really at the heart of all future climate change scenarios. It's not just that the climate is changing. It's how plants and animals respond. And, you know, if every species on the planet got along just fine in any kind of weather, then you could tweak the climate around all you wanted, and it would hardly make a difference. But of course, we all know that's not how nature works. There is this great diversity of creatures and so forth on the planet that are all specialized to particular environmental niches. And when you start to change the climate, they respond to try to find a path forward. And that's what I really wanted to explore, was to expand our conversation around those biological reactions to a changing climate.
I saw a quote from you that you said, though rooted in climate crisis, this is not a crisis book. Can you share what you meant by that?
Yes, absolutely. I wanted to shine a light not only on the creatures that are struggling to adapt, but the creatures that are surprising us with their flexibility, with their plasticity in nature, their ability to respond to changing conditions. And so I tried to take a very clear-eyed view of these examples and look for what's really happening, what we can measure and see in the field right now. And so some of the stories are, you know, surprisingly hopeful as well. And so that is what I mean, in that it's not just about the crisis, but also about some of the surprising hopeful signs that we see, at least for some species in nature.
What is it about certain species that allows, say, one type to adapt while others struggle to adapt? Is there common elements in that?
That is such a great question. And how many hours do we have on this program? This is great. Right into it now. No, you've really hit on it. And that's one of the reasons that climate change biologists focus on this stuff, is to try to, in a sense, tell us what species we need to worry about. Because some species are clearly better equipped than others to deal with this period of rapid change. And when we start to look at it with that lens, we see that specialists, those species that have gotten really good at doing some narrow thing in nature, are the ones that are struggling the most. Whereas the generalists, the jack of all trades sort of species, have more tools in their tool belt to deal with change. And that's an important distinction in that if you look back over evolutionary time, those sorts of general strategies, if you will, always wax and wane in nature, in that there are advantages both ways. If you are in a period of stasis where things aren't changing for a long period of time, specialization is a really good trick to develop because it'll give you some sort of an edge over the other species you're competing with. I live in the Pacific Northwest, and we look at our resident orcas, our resident killer whales, several pods that have become particularly good at catching one type of salmon, and they're better than anything out there in nature at catching that one kind of salmon, which is a great strategy during a period of stasis when there were plenty of salmon and things weren't changing. But now we have climate change in addition to overfishing and the loss of habitat for salmon, and that specialization then in a period of change is a liability. Whereas if you look then at other species who have taken more of a generalist approach, they're in a better situation to adapt to a changing climate. So we see that right now as we go through this period of change, that those species long term that have been generalists have an edge.
Yeah, and I'm curious because you've spent decades in field projects in biology. At what point do you remember really that shift that everything was, you're looking through this lens and your research through climate change instead of just field biology?
I think this has happened to pretty much every biologist out there. I think you can say with some certainty that all biologists are studying climate change right now. Some of them just don't know it yet. And that is that if you are out in nature seeing how plants and animals respond, whatever you're studying, you know, in all these fields of biology, all these different specialties, you're seeing things change quickly, and you're seeing the responses. So one of the underlying themes that I took from my research for this book, which was not only things that I had studied in the field, but also talking with a lot of scientists doing interesting field projects. And what happens again and again now is people go out into the field expecting to study one thing, and they find that things are so different than what they expected that they come back with a very different data set. Their questions have changed and their data have changed. And as a great example of that, I like to point to this project that was going on in Kodiak Island, where they were studying the brown bears, and they were fascinated by how these brown bears always seem to manage their time so well and always be at a particular stream during the peak of the salmon run. So they had gone out and they radio collared a bunch of bears, and they were out there and they were getting their data, and it looked great. They were counting the fish in the stream. This was all lining up perfectly. And then right in the middle of their field season, the bears just disappeared. They left all the streams. And they thought, well, what on earth is going on? And luckily, they had radio tagged these bears, or at least some of them, and so they could follow them. And they realized that the bears had left the streams, they'd gone up into the hills to feast on a particular kind of berry, the red elderberry, right? Which happens to be now blooming and then fruiting weeks earlier than it used to because of climate change. And so in this scenario where we have this image in our heads that a bear will do anything for salmon and nothing else, you know, it's happy as Larry eating salmon. It's not going to do anything to change that. At the peak of the salmon season, a bear will leave the stream if there are elderberries ripe. And it led to this different set of questions about how good food for bears, elderberries happen to be. They're strange berries. They're not sweet at all, but they have a lot of protein. So they really do balance out the bear's diet in a way that a high protein food like a salmon, you know, there are a lot of salmon around, so they eat them, but they have a hard time gaining a lot of weight on salmon. And so if you've got something that combines proteins and starches the way these berries do, oh, the bears, they just leave the streams and they go right up there. And that is a classic example of how this climate change sort of overarching influence on all of these natural systems is altering what we study, altering how we understand nature, even something as classic as a sort of bear-salmon relationship, which we really thought we had figured out.
So staying in the Northwest, if an orca is an example of, as you described, kind of a specialist, the generalists, I was thinking maybe those bears, brown bears, could be considered generalists, or maybe sea otters, examples of generalists as far as their diet goes, that they can eat scallops, and now they seem to be loving the green crabs that are beginning to populate that area, those waters more. I'm not sure why the green crabs, Matt, it's a separate story, are suddenly showing up. But are otters with a diversified diet considered more generalist?
In diet, in that regard, yes. Yeah. Or if you look at, species, well, like your bear, the bears, for example, generalists. They'll eat berries, they'll eat clams, they'll eat fish, they will eat, you know, they will scavenge, they'll do whatever it takes, you know. So those sorts of are now extremely valuable. And you see it really in that bear example. Okay, you know, they've got the salmon going, but they can go and shift to berries and put on even more weight than they were putting on when they were eating the fish. So that's, yes, you're right on it. You want to look for those species that if you're sort of in a period of, you know, conservation biology triage, you're looking to help the species that need it the most. And those are the ones that have specialized in general, or have some aspect of their life cycle that is particularly afflicted by the changing climate.
Okay, but again, that, so their diet might be generalized, but perhaps their habitat might be specialized too. So is that another element? And maybe you can, you know, and climate becomes a challenge too. If some creatures, well, birds can migrate, you know, and actually go from, you know, one climate to another. So generalization and specialization becomes a real matrix of elements, components to it to solve. And they may have four or five of them, of those elements solved, but the fifth one might be a real problem for them.
Absolutely. It's extremely complicated when you start to really narrow in and focus on some creatures, particularly examples of plants or animals that have, you know, complex life histories. I mean, if you look at something, since we're doing, we're sort of on this Northwestern kick, if you look at the Pacific salmon, you're looking at a species that interacts with major biomes that are changing in different ways throughout its life cycle. You know, it starts life and it can be in a mountain stream, and then it goes down to an estuary and out into the near shore and then out into the deep pelagic ocean, and then do that whole trip in reverse. And all of those different habitats are responding to climate change in different ways. So yes, you have, you know, this matrix of problems that species are facing. They can be dietary, they can be habitat related, temperature related. And it's any one of those that can make life difficult for them. in a changing climate. A really interesting example as well, just to bust out of the Northwest for a moment and get to the desert, down a little closer to where you are. You said you're down in New Mexico right now, in Utah and so forth. Well, if you go down to the Mojave Desert, you might think to yourself, well, hey, you know, the species here should have it made. I mean, they're already living in the hottest place in North America. Why is climate change a problem for something like a Western fence lizard living in the Mojave Desert? And this research was done by a group led by Barry Sinervo, who's a wonderful herpetologist and a terrific fellow. And he and others were, I think they were sitting around at a conference, and they started talking about this problem because they had noticed that some of these fence lizard populations that they knew about and had studied for years were sort of winking out in hot parts of the Southwest. And that got them started on this research project where they tried to figure out what was happening. And they learned that, in fact, you know, when things get hot, the response of lizards, who are what we say in biology heliotherms, they regulate their temperature with the sun. They, you know, go into the shade. That's what they always do. You see it on a hot day. If you've ever tried to catch a fence lizard, you know it's going to scurry under a rock. They're never very far from a rock, because part of the reason they stick close to that habitat is so they can get out of the sun when they get too hot. So if you crank up the temperature, they've got a response. They just spend more time in the shade. But if they spend too much time in the shade, it impacts how much time they have to forage for food. And so they got enough data to be able to predict and find this crux point where if the lizards were spending more sun, they weren't getting enough calories, particularly the female lizards. So if you spend too much time under a rock and you're a female lizard, you do not add enough calories to your diet to be able to reproduce. You can't mate and carry, you know, there are various strategies for those lizards. Some give live birth, some don't. But, you know, at any rate, you can't mate. You can't reproduce. And it doesn't take, you know, the PhD in herpetology to know what the ultimate result of that is going to be. If there's no reproduction, these populations are winking out. And so they were able to make that connection and to figure out that in this case, it's not the direct impact of heat. They've got a strategy to deal with heat. They've been doing it forever. But if you do that on a few hot days a year, no big deal. But if you do it consistently as the temperatures rise, you can't reproduce. And so these questions are fascinating, and it's very revealing and instructive to see what species respond, how they respond.
You've been in this field for so long. Was there anything that you uncovered that literally kind of took you back, or you weren't expecting at all? Or was that across the board?
You know, there were a lot of surprises along the way in the work for this book, in that, and I think it's indicative of how many surprises biologists are encountering in their work right now because of how things are changing. And one of them that stuck with me was the example of the dove keys, or little auks, which are a beautiful little seabird. If you can imagine that iceberg scenario that we talked about on the top, and if you push the polar bear to the side and peered over the edge of that iceberg, you might see a dove key, also called a little auk, which is a little alcid, a beautiful little seabird, feeding along the edge of that ice floe, because that has been their strategy for thousands of years. Where that fresh water is melting and combining with the sea water, there is a good place for the zooplankton and so forth that they feed upon. So this has been their strategy. They've been doing it for thousands of years. But scientists have been worried about them in a warming planet because they breed on rocky islands, places like, in Greenland and so forth. But the, you know, a classic for them is the Franz Josef Land Archipelago in Russia. But if you look at those places now, the sea ice is retreating farther and farther from the islands. Those adult birds are not going to be able to reach the edge of the ice, in an efficient way to feed their chicks that are sitting there at the nest on the island. There's a pretty easy formula there. At some point, the round trip is just too far, and the chicks starve. And again, you see a population suffer. So they have been sort of a poster child at risk for climate change for a long time. But when a group went up there to Franz Josef Land to study this, they were stunned by what they saw. They put, again, radio tags on these little birds. They'd done this in other places, and they knew how far birds could fly, and they had their hypotheses and expectations. And then they got their first bit of data, and they're up at this, you know, abandoned Soviet era, you know, research station in these cold little huts, and they're crowded around with their Russian counterparts, and they open up the laptop and look at the first day's data. And the birds had been in the air. Now, they were expecting, you know, an hour to reach where the sea ice was. The birds had been in the air round trip 4 minutes. So where are these birds going? So they're totally stunned. And they realized that something totally different was occurring, and that at the mouth of the fjord on this island, you could see where the glacial meltwater from the glaciers on the island was mixing with the seawater. It was just that milky glacial water hitting the dark waters of the Arctic Ocean there. And at that point, where those two kinds of water, two densities, two sorts of water impact one another and mix, for the little copepods and crustaceans swimming through the ocean, that is like swimming full speed into a brick wall. And it's a pileup, right? They're just thousands of them there, stunned or even dead. And for the dovekies, it's a bonanza. So here they had been expecting their dovekie populations to be crashing, and in fact they found that they were thriving, and flying just right on their very doorstep was this incredible food source that had been created as a byproduct of the warming climate. So in this case, they calculate that with the rates of glacial melt and so forth going on there, that those dovekies have bought themselves 100 years, maybe even 200 years time to find other ways to adapt to this changing climate. Because that old strategy of feeding on the edge of the pack ice was a losing strategy as the ice got too far away. But they were able to pivot to something brand new.
We're speaking with Tor Hansen. He's a biologist and author of a number of books, including the one we're talking about today, Hurricane Lizards and Plastic Squid, The Fraught and Fascinating Biology of Climate Change. So Tor, let's talk about the title characters, Hurricane Lizards and Plastic Squid. Have at it.
You know, it's a funny thing in the title. I will often go out and lecture about a book, and I often spend the first part, you know, explaining the idea behind the book and explaining this and that. And I realized with this book, if I can explain the title, then people will understand the premise of the book completely. So we've got two examples wrapped up in that title. And I'm going to start with the squid first, because we've been talking already in our time together about a lot of rapid adaptations that various creatures have made. And in biology, we call that ability, sort of the inherent ability to change quickly, plasticity. And if you remember the old comic book character Plastic Man, well, here was this fellow who could stretch his body into any shape at moment's notice and solve crimes in imaginative ways. Well, we wish that all species out there were like Plastic Man now to be able to adapt to climate change. But what this really means is the built-in ability to adapt. So it's already something that's within the DNA of a species that they can pivot on a dime, you know, like those dovekies, with a behavioral response or even a physiological response in some cases. And if you were to have sort of an Olympics of elasticity, the Humboldt squid would be on the podium, probably taking gold, maybe silver or bronze, but certainly on the podium as Olympics, because the Humboldt squid reacts in such a dramatic fashion to a warming ocean. If you look down in the Gulf of California, there's been a traditional squid fishery for years. If you order squid in a restaurant, you're often getting a Humboldt squid. They also call it the jumbo squid because they're so large. They can be 6 feet long, these amazing creatures. So there's been a fishery for them for decades. And then they just disappeared following a couple of marine heat waves that swept through that area, these climate-driven events that have continued and warmed the waters of the Gulf of California, and the squid were gone. And so, you know, everyone figured, the fishers and so forth, figured that the squid were responding the way so many species are, by picking up and moving, looking for their comfort zone, looking for the water temperatures they're used to. They went somewhere else. But when biologists actually looked for the squid, they found they were still there in abundance, but they had responded with this plastic response to the warming waters. Something in either the egg or larval stage of that squid being raised in a warmer ocean triggered a different growth pattern and a different lifestyle, so that the squid were maturing in half the time, and they were eating different foods, and they were growing at a different rate, and they were maturing at a fraction of the size that they used to. So you had, instead of these jumbo squid, which could be 6 feet long, you were looking at fully mature breeding population of squid that were only about a foot, 14 inches, tiny little things. So the too small to bite on the jigs that people traditionally used to catch them, which is why everyone thought they were gone. And the few that they did hook, they were throwing back, thinking they were immatures or thinking they were another species altogether. So that is a plastic response, in that ability to have a totally different lifestyle was baked into the squid's DNA.
And that was occurring over the course of one generation or two generations of squid, because I think that's part of the challenge here, is the fact that animals that, you know, their reproductive rates are dozens and dozens of years, or if you're a leatherback turtle, you're not, you know, you're reproducing at very slow rates. I would think that's a big hurdle to come over. But again, going back to these Humboldt squid, they were adapting and building resiliency within one or two generations.
That you've just hit on it, because if you were relying upon evolution to get you out of that fix, you'd need generation after generation after generation, and natural selection weeding out those few individuals, weeding out the individuals that couldn't deal with warm water and focusing on the ones that could. The key to plasticity is that it's already there. So this is a one generation shift. And in fact, if you can imagine how this may have developed, you're looking at a species of squid that has a huge range in nature. You know, all the way up in from the North Pacific down to the South Pacific. So over the wide range of that population, they are exposed to different ocean conditions. And so the gene pool, given the mixing in the population that has developed over time, has a lot of variability built in to the individual. So that if you could imagine having a tank of squid, Humboldt squid breeding, you could more or less control the size of those squid by adjusting the water temperature. In that, during that egg or juvenile stage, or larval stage, I should say, that early stage, something is triggered either way. And we can recognize this ability in ourselves as well. And I think that's something critical about understanding plasticity. And one of the classics would be during World War II, when there were food shortages and other stresses on the human population in Europe. If you look at the growth rates of people during that period of time, you know, children that were born and exposed to those stressful conditions in the womb and in early childhood took different life strategy. They were short in stature as they grew older. Even if they were exposed to greater amounts of food later in childhood, those early years put you on a particular track in terms of your physiology. It's almost as if something about the environment triggers a response in the genetic code saying, this is a stressful situation. And if you grow to full size or to the maximum potential, it's going to be hard to support that body size. So we're tracking on a different, slightly different track to be smaller. So that's a human example of the same sort of concept we see in those squid. If they're exposed to warm temperatures as an egg or in the larval phase, it switches the developmental track to a small body size, saying you don't want to be 6 feet long when you grow up because you're not going to be able to sustain a body size that huge. So you're going to be a small, humble squid.
So fascinating. Unfortunately, we have to wrap up there. We have Tor Hansen, who is a biologist, conservationist, Guggenheim fellow, and author of Hurricane Lizards and Plastic Squid with us. And thank you so much, Tor, for all the information that you have given us. Is there a website or a place people can go to learn more about you and your writings?
Of course, yeah, it's torhanson.net, torhanson.net.
And again, super fascinating. We could talk to you forever, and we are going to have you back on the show because you have an upcoming book, and we're excited to do that.
Yes, the next book coming out is called Close to Home, and I look forward to chatting with you about that.
Perfect. Same here. Thanks, Tor.
Thank you so
much.
My
pleasure. Thank you.
We are now turning our attention to the ocean with author Susan Casey, who comes on the show to share more about her writings, including her latest book. It was in 2023, I believe this was released, The Underworld Journeys to the Depths of the Ocean. Welcome, Susan, to the show.
Thank you.
Well, I'm so excited to have you on the show, and I have so many questions for you about your research and your writing. But first, I want to get to know you better. You've had quite an interesting career outside of writing about the ocean. Tell us a little bit more about you and your background to start.
Well, I guess I have been sort of in and out of the publishing world in various ways for a long time. But before I turned my attention to really just focusing on the ocean and writing books about it, I was a magazine editor. I was the editor-in-chief of Oprah's magazine. I was the editor-at-large for Time Inc., large magazine. I have to explain what it was now because it doesn't exist anymore. Mm-hmm. Very large magazine publishing company. I was the creative director of Outside Magazine. And as I was working on stories at Outside, it really dovetailed with my own interests. My background in sports was as a competitive swimmer. I swam on the Canadian team and competed internationally. And so I was always very interested in water. But growing up in Canada, I didn't have a lot of access or exposure to the ocean until my first book, which was called The Devil's Teeth, about the Farallon Islands off the coast of San Francisco and the neighborhood of resident great white sharks that live there, and these really cool but very unorthodox scientists who were studying them. And when I started spending time at the Farallons, I realized that the ocean was really the big show in terms of just everything that I was interested in, my affinity towards water. And it just seemed to me that there was this parallel universe beneath the surface, and it is so much more vast than everything above the surface. And so, you know, I just became extremely compelled by its grandeur and its mystery and all the things that, you know, I just had a million questions. And that's what I've set out to do with my, it's now four books that I've written that are really focused on the ocean, on various topics: giant waves, great white sharks, the relationship between humans and dolphins and whales, and now the deep ocean, which is 95% of the biosphere of Earth and the realm that we know the least.
Absolutely. I have a fascination and a fear of the ocean, both because of so much that we don't understand about the ocean and so many of those mysteries. And I feel like I'm so ill-equipped to handle what's happening beneath the surface. But you have developed this fascination with this world. And can you talk us through what process that you take in writing your books, because I have to imagine that the research is long and intensive. You're talking about different zones of the ocean. So talk us a little bit through that research, and then let's get into the zones and how you kind of developed an understanding of them.
Sure. So yes, it takes me about 5 years to write a book. And in the case of The Underworld, it took me 7 years. And it's a really deep, a really deep immersive dive into the subject matter. And I spend a lot of time with scientists, and I am not a scientist. I see myself as a proxy for the curious person. Mm-hmm. So I'll go in there and try to be a bridge between these incredible scientific discoveries and stories and the lay audience that may not be aware of them and may not speak the scientific language. And so in my books, we really go on a journey and we have a lot of fun. I was described one time as John McPhee on speed, and that's sort of what it's like. We're going to go everywhere. And my goal is to take the readers along with me. So for everything that I write in this immersive way, I really have to have a sort of essential knowledge about it in order to be able to distill it. So in the case of The Underworld, it was a lot because there are, there are different ways of delineating this, but for my purposes, I use the one that's most common, that there are four regions of the deep ocean, and each one of them has all kinds of separate biological characteristics and geological characteristics. And so there were all these zones, all these different sciences, different scientists, and I really traveled around the world and far beneath the surface of the water to be able to report it.
Yeah. Can you talk us through the zones of the ocean, kind of walk us through that so we can get more of a visual of what the depths as you continue to go down that delineation between all of them?
Uh-huh. So everybody thinks of the ocean as the area that we know the best, which is the sunlight zone. And that's what we see when we look out at the horizon. But that is generally thought to be the zone that, where sunlight permeates. And that's for purposes of naming these zones, scientists consider that to be a 0 to 600 feet. And then below 600 feet, all the way to the deepest spot in the ocean, which is called the Challenger Deep, and it's in the Mariana Trench, it's almost 36,000 feet. It's like 35,876 feet. So it's a vast area. And the uppermost layer of the deep ocean is called the Twilight Zone, if you want to get technical about it, the Mesopelagic. The Twilight Zone I love because it's more evocative of the place. Mm-hmm. You travel through the twilight waters and then into the, it's from 600 feet down to about 3,300 feet. And it's really fascinating part of the ocean because it has more creatures than all the other regions of the ocean combined. I call it the Manhattan of the deep because it's just always on the move. There are literally trillions of fish and other animals in there, and they're quite tiny, and most of them are bioluminescent. And so it's really a very visually stimulating place to dive in a submersible. You see them twinkling, and there aren't that many creatures on land that use bioluminescence, but in the Twilight Zone, approximately 80% of them do. So you'll jostle into them and they'll light up. And what you realize when you go there is that it is not space. We're not in space when we travel into the deep ocean. It's just a matrix of life. And every cubic inch of water is just alive with organisms, microorganisms, and they're flashing and they're swimming around. And you just see like the incredible richness of the ecosystem. And below that is from 1,000 to 3,000 meters, a vast midwater area called, for the purposes of making it easy, I'll call it the Midnight Zone, Bathypelagic Zone. And it's another area which is characterized by, there's bioluminescence, but it's not quite as dense. There are some larger creatures in the Midnight Zone, and that's where you'll find the giant squid. There's a lot of deep sea sharks there. Many cetaceans like beaked whales and sperm whales and even deep sea sharks will swim around in there. So you'll find the larger creatures there too, and it's a little less dense. Below that is the abyssal zone, short, let's call it the abyss, the literal abyss, from 3,000 meters to 6,000 meters, and it's the largest ecosystem on Earth. And wherever the abyss meets the seafloor in the world, you will find all kinds of different large geological features, including really vast plains, a 40,000-mile volcano that encircles the Earth, which is the seam where tectonic plates are pulling apart, and hydrothermal vents, these volcanic ecosystems that have their own crazy, weird and wonderful forms of life. Mm-hmm. You'll find mountains, you'll find canyons. I mean, it's just vast and dramatic. And below that is the most mysterious realm of the deep ocean. It's called the Hadal Zone, named after Hades, the god of the underworld, or the realm of the underworld. And it's a really fascinating area, and it's just beginning to open up to scientists now. And it is from 6,000 to almost 11,000 meters, and it occurs only on 2% of the ocean floor, but it accounts for 45% of the depth of the ocean. So it's these very steep trenches that occur where tectonic plates are colliding. And when they do, one will end up being, it's known as subduction, subducted underneath the other plate. These two plates are wrestling. One of them is getting slowly driven downwards, and the friction and force of that will eventually cause it to melt back into the mantle. So it's this vast machinery of geological forces. And when you get something like the Mariana Trench, which is the trench that people know the most, it is about 44 miles wide, but 1,500 miles long. And as mentioned, goes from 6,000 to almost 11,000 meters. So it's, imagine taking the Himalayas and turning them upside down. Mm-hmm. And the life that exists in the Hadal Zone is extremely adapted, of course, to these extreme pressures. Like at the bottom of the Mariana Trench, it's like 16,000 pounds of pressure per square inch. So, and there is life all the way to the very seafloor, and even below it, thousands of meters below it, there is another ecosystem beneath the seafloor called the deep biosphere that's microbial, and that is also just on the cutting edge of science.
Well, there is so much left to the imagination, and all of that is people and our listeners, and I'm thinking about this vastness of the ocean, its many layers, its depths, how we are trying to get further and further down to learn more and more and more. Obviously, the pressure is not conducive for humans to be down there. But before we get into that, I want to talk about, when we think about the ocean, a lot of times it invokes thoughts of these large living beings in the oceans, those sharks, those whales. But in the ocean, it really comes down to those smallest organisms that make the biggest difference in our environment. Can you talk about that a little bit, about some of the organisms in the ocean that are playing such a big role in life itself, not only in the ocean, but for us?
Exactly. You're exactly right. And one of the most astonishing things, I think we often overlook it, in fact, we probably always overlook it, is that the microbes basically run this joint. And the ocean is, the deep ocean has a huge microbial biomass. And the microbial activities in the deep ocean are responsible for all kinds of geochemical and biogeochemical cycles that just keep the Earth in the balance that we know and that makes it possible for us to live here. And so there are all kinds of organisms that, you know, have a different type of life than what we typically think of as life. They will exist in environments that for us and for, you know, land-dwelling creatures would be completely toxic. And those are some of the oldest organisms called archaea. And they will be found in hydrothermal vents. They have all kinds of metabolisms that do strange things like ingest iron and excrete rust. And all of these things just sort of bubble on beneath the surface, unbeknownst to us, but also making it possible for us to thrive in the sunlight. And that's the same kind of microbial diversity has been there for hundreds of millions of years and is still sort of present in the background. So right now we have a certain temperature in the ocean, we have a certain pH in the ocean, and that's changing. And one of the things I find really fascinating and am starting to dig deeper into right now is what's known as the rare biosphere. And that is basically all these microbes that aren't on center stage right now, but that are sort of waiting in the background. If conditions change, a different type of ecosystem might spring up and they will come to the foreground. So there is this archive, the Earth's archive of genomic creativity that's in this, it's in the living sediments of the seafloor, it's beneath the seafloor and the ocean, the nooks and crannies of the ocean crust, it's in the hydrothermal vents. It's so enormous that we don't even really know the extent of it. So it's one of the more fascinating areas to dive into, but it's also very complicated science. And if you want to go a little larger, I would take you back up to the Twilight Zone, where these tiny fish, and I mean, I said there are trillions. Some people will say there could be quadrillions. They are really important to the overall functioning of the Earth, because every night they will rise up the water column. So imagine having to hike up a mountain to get your breakfast. They go under cover of darkness. They rise up at night. They eat phytoplankton, which are carbon units, you know, little single-celled plants that are nourished by the sunlight, so carbon. Eat the phytoplankton, swim back down to the Twilight Zone, excrete it, maybe get eaten by larger fish. And in that way, carbon is removed from the atmosphere and sequestered in the deep ocean. It's a biological carbon pump. And it's also the world's largest animal migration, and it happens every single day. Wow. So it's really incredibly intricate and in flux. And scientists are very focused on it now, because it's one of the reasons why the ocean has been able to gulp down so much of our excess heat and carbon dioxide from burning fossil fuels. And we certainly do not want to do anything to upset that. And we would like to learn more about how it works and who's doing what. But often I will show pictures of these. People see pictures of these deep sea fish with giant teeth, and a lot of them have big eyes. And they just look like they're from Nightmare Central casting, but they're like 3 inches long and completely adorable. And they're part of the biological carbon pump too.
Well, let's talk about that. Let's get into the ocean in this time of accelerated climate change and how it's sequestering carbon and why that's of so much importance to us. You know, as we get into these conversations about deep sea mining and the potential hazards, not only that could unleash, but the havoc it could wreak in this day and age of climate change. And I know we don't have a lot of time to talk about that, and it's a huge topic, but can you cover a little bit of that for us?
Yeah, I mean, deep sea mining, in a nutshell, would be the most destructive thing that humans would have ever done on Earth by an order of magnitude if it goes forward. And I dearly hope it doesn't, and I actually believe that it won't, because for a lot of reasons. First of all, it would destroy vast areas of the seafloor. Like, each mine site is approximately 30,000 square miles. And probably listeners aren't aware that it doesn't occur right now at industrial scale, although lots of people have had their eye on the minerals of the seafloor for a long time. It hasn't made a lot of economic sense. One of the reasons why it's sort of rearing its head now is because there are nodules on the bottom of usually at abyssal depths, that contain nickel and cobalt, but also manganese and copper. Really, it's all about the nickel and cobalt. And the sort of the line that you will hear from deep sea mining boosters is that we must have these nickel and cobalt reserves in order to decarbonize, defossilize. But that's false. First of all, they now know that these metallic nodules are creating what they call dark oxygen. So they're actually emitting a sort of a voltage that splits water molecules into hydrogen and oxygen. So they are another source of oxygen creation in the ocean. They have been down there in what is a relatively untouched area, and they occur over vast areas of the seafloor, but their habitat for microbes live inside them, under them, on top of them. They're a substrate for all kinds of other creatures. There's incredible biodiversity all around them. So a lot of the creatures that rely on these nodules, we don't know them. In the area that's most earmarked for this, which is between Mexico and Hawaii, 93% of the species that are brought up, scientists are just racing to study this because, you know, it seems the height of recklessness to destroy an ecosystem when we don't even know what's there. And it could be one of the systems that is keeping us alive. So they've been out there rushing to find out. And as I mentioned, 93% of the species are unknown, not just new actual species, but sometimes new families and genera and new types of life, not just animal that you can see with your eyes, but microorganisms as well. So it is just, at the very least, scientists have said we need 10 to 30 years of further study to even know what we would be doing. And that we would, it would be probably best if we just leave this system alone. It's the womb of the earth. And we don't even need these minerals at all. Battery chemistries are moving away from cobalt and nickel. Nobody wants to use cobalt. I mean, it's horrible on land. It would be even worse to get it from the deep ocean. So that's deep sea mining in a nutshell. And I always refer people to the Deep Sea Conservation Coalition to find out more. I just really think that if we are dumb, I don't think we are insane enough to do it.
Yeah, it seems like the more that we want to extract or remove or shake up our natural world, obviously the volatileness of that comes back and as a negative towards us, because the planet is actually trying to keep us alive, believe it or not. So in the last couple minutes, I loved reading reviews about your book, The Underworld, because so many reviewers said that they earmarked portions of it and went back and Googled it and wanted to learn more about it. It's so fascinating. The topic is so interesting, and how you put it together is so wonderful that you are getting people involved. And it's encouraging to me to hear that more people want to understand and know what's happening, because like you said, the ocean is such a life force for us here on Earth. So when you're writing this, what would be the ideal action items or takeaways for readers?
I really always aim to instill enchantment and curiosity. And that's why I really wanted to dive. And I got to go into the abyss, almost to the bottom of the abyss. And that is not an experience that the average person will have. So I want to take everybody along with me. Mm. And so it's just a real richness of detail. And maybe that's why people feel like a lot of people have told me they sort of look at every other paragraph, they'll be Googling what something looks like. And, you know, there's great undersea cinematography, but prose on the page is a different medium that sort of ironically allows you to go deeper than you can on screen. So it's great to be able to sort of accompany it. There's inserts of photos in the book, but it's great to be able to sort of go off on a tangent and find out about some particular animal or some particular site. And I just really want to remind people that, 95% of the biosphere exists in the dark. We don't know it. People do tend to be scared of it and think, okay, it's dark, it's spooky, it's all this. But what people don't realize is how magnificent it is, how alive, how serene, and it has a real gravitas. One of the things I love the most about it is it really instills a sense of humility.
Absolutely.
We are part of nature. We don't run this joint. And you can't even think that for one second when you're dropping down to 6,000 meters in a submersible.
Right. Well, the book is called The Underworld: Journeys to the Depths of the Ocean. We are speaking with Susan Casey, who is the author and has written three other books regarding the ocean. And SusanCasey.com is the place to go to learn more. Thank you for listening to This Green Earth on KPCW.